This is Roz Bornstein, and this is tape two of Alice Siegel's oral history, and the date is still July 10th, 2001, and Alice and I are meeting at Alice's home in Seattle, Washington, for the Weaving Women's Words Project of the Jewish Women's Archive. And Alice, do I still have your permission to interview and tape you?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. We were talking about your courtship with your husband, Art, and you were describing how your mom was, well, you can, why don't you describe it?
Okay.
Feelings.
Well, she was really upset, mainly because she felt that, you know, that I wouldn't go to college then, and I was much too young, which of course I was. And my father wasn't happy about it either, but he was, you know, sort of, well, if that's what it's going to be, well, you know, that's it. And so I, my mother was so upset. It went on and on. But
can you describe what messages, you know, did she really, did she have a strong belief in education for you, or what was the concern on her part?
You know, I really don't remember. It's just that I was too young. And, you know, when I think about it now, because you know, that was much too young, but I think had she presented it in some way, why don't you wait until maybe you've had a year or two of college or finish college or something like that, you know, I think I would have been willing to listen, but it was just, you know, it was just, you're too young. And, of course, that just made me more stubborn. You know, if you don't want somebody to do things, especially your child, at a certain age, maybe any age, I don't know. You don't beat them on the head, you know, with no's, but you think about something that might work. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe it would have. But anyway, so that was...
within the Jewish community at that time, was 17 a young age to be
yes,
dating?
Yes, it was a shock.
Okay. So to put it in context then,
yeah.
At that time, what was the...
Kind of the age?
Typical or I don't know.
I would say among those of us who were planning to go on to college, probably after they completed college, would have been the typical age. Actually, my cousins, the one I admired so much, and then she had two other sisters who I also liked very much, they all married later, and they're much later. So it was, for my generation, that was kind of a throwback.
But the two of you fell in love?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's difficult, and when you're both pretty young, and but I always felt, you know, well, we can work things out. But then, as the war, you know, progressed, and actually, my father needed me more in his business because then, you know, the tragedy of the economy is, you know, when there's a war, the economy gets very busy and grows, but it, you know, of course, you're reading the news, and there was no television at that time. I mean, it was horrible, and my husband was doing some testing on a Boeing plane, and so he had to do high altitude testing. I guess he was testing the electrical system, because he is an electrical engineer. And so he had very long days and also a lot of flying at very high altitudes. And he was just exhausted when he'd get home. And so it was kind of a stressful time. Mm-hmm. And but after the war, my husband, without saying anything to me, quit his job at Boeing, he and another fellow engineer, and they decided to go into business for themselves. And my husband said, asked me to, if I get my parents to loan some money for the business, and that he would need me in the to do the office work and the bookkeeping, and that was something that really made me very angry, because there was no talking to me first. But I did those things, and the first several years, one thing that happened, let's see, the war ended in 45. My father had a massive heart attack in November of 45, and he died. And as you know, I said we were very close. And that was just absolutely devastating to me.
How so?
Because I felt so close to him, that, and the fact that, okay, here's the situation where I knew that he had a heart condition. And because when we worked at the store before I got married, we used to walk home sometimes from First Avenue to 26th in East Alder. And later, he would be out of breath, and he said, "I just can't do it." And so we would just go to the bus, and again, I don't know, bus or streetcar, probably streetcar, and go home. And I really denied to myself, and of course at that time I didn't know that much about, I don't know that anybody knew that much about heart conditions and so forth, but I guess I felt, you know, whether I could have done anything, I'm sure I couldn't have, but I just felt that I felt very badly that it happened, and so it just left me feeling very bereaved and very sad. So that took quite a while to get over. And then after I began, you know, feel better, I did become pregnant with our first child, who is named after my father. And so he was born in October of 46. And, well, we were, and my husband now is in his business, and it was not doing well financially, and so we barely were managing, and it was a real, excuse me, it was a hardship for a number of years. And so that bothered me, because, you know, I felt I should have been more involved. I should have been
involved
in the decision to go into business.
Oh, I see.
Also, he should have used me more as a partner than as the woman who does the office work. And so that really bothered me. And so that's when I decided. Well, I didn't decide. Then the second child came along 19 months later, and it was a difficult. So the early years became difficult, the stress of the war and his job, and then my father's death, and then the financial difficulties. And then we had the second child. I did become depressed. I became very depressed. I was fortunate enough to be able to get help. And I was so fortunate that there was a clinic had been open called Pinel. And I was referred to it. You paid what you could afford. So that was, I mean, otherwise it would have been no way. And also, I was very wary of many of the people in that field that I'd hear stories about, and I'd think, oh God, I don't want to get involved with anybody like that. And so I was very fortunate. The psychiatrist that I was seeing was trained, I don't know where he was trained, but he came from the famous Menninger. I don't, I always forget whether it's Menninger or Menninger, but I think it's Menninger. Anyway, and he was wonderful, and that's where I was able to kind of pull things together and realize, okay, I am going to go to the university. As soon as our daughter entered the first grade, because we still have very little money, so I had to do it while the kids were in school. And so as soon as she entered first grade, I enrolled at the University of Washington. And but I went part-time so I could be home, you know, when the kids were home. And so it took 7 years to get a bachelor's degree. But I got it.
It's remarkable that you were able to juggle all of that. If you don't mind taking a step back for just a second, I was wondering, in your experience, when you felt depressed and you sought help, what was it like at that time for women to do that? Was it talked about much, or was it something that was
No,
rare?
At that time it was rare.
Okay.
They began to have women's programs and orientations for older women. I think I was 40 when I went back.
Terms of getting help for depression, how did you take that step at that time?
Well, I was seeing a doctor, you know, physical things, and then the doctor I was seeing referred me to, and we were belonged to group health from very early days, and referred me to, I don't know if you know, B. Sachs, whose specialty was psychosomatic medicine. And so she was very helpful. And so she referred me to Pinnell. And I was deeply grateful, because knowing that this was, you know, a very fine staff, that I would be able to get the help I knew I needed that time. And so actually I was going 4 times a week. And a very reasonable, $5 a session. So, but even that was a hardship. But I don't know when I guess I felt so relieved that I was having the opportunity to work out issues, and it did help. So actually, I probably would have continued longer. Although I had 100 hours of psychotherapy, and but then the psychiatrist moved to California to open up a private practice, and I didn't want to start with anyone else, and I figured, well, I'll manage. And
that's such a change from now, isn't it? With what is provided through managed care, 100 hours.
I know.
This was through group health. Is that?
Well, they referred me to Pinnell. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Right.
And that was your insurance, or was
that? It's a cooperative health insurance organization.
I'm not exactly sure how well known group health is nationally, and
time it wasn't well known.
Could you tell us how did you get hooked up with it, and tell us a little bit
okay.
about group health?
Yeah.
That history.
Well, that I guess we joined in 1948. And it was a very young, struggling organization. And how I found out about it, my younger brother took a job there while he was going to the university. And I'm sure he was at the university, so it was to promote the organization, the group health, and to get memberships. And so the way he explained it, it sounded great to me, and I like the idea of a cooperative. This is a member's own, and it was, and that's really what it was at the beginning. I mean, it still is, but now it has many contracts with employer groups. So now they have so they have different kind of memberships, and but at that time, so I recall the doctors were. I think it was the security building, in the security building in downtown Seattle. Maybe a half dozen doctors. And they were having a lot of problems. The King County Medical Association wouldn't recognize them. They couldn't use other hospitals, and so they bought this old hospital that they used. Of course, at that time, I'd already had my second child, so there was no hospital use for me. And but you know, I just liked the idea of the cooperative. And then they had, I'm not sure if they were called district councils, which they do have now. I'm not sure if that's what it was called in those days. But so I decided, you know, to go to those meetings, and then I was elected to an office. What was it? I don't know if I was vice president or secretary, what it was. Well, I was not president or chair of that committee. And but, you know, it was an interesting group of people, and learned about, you know, what was going on. And
this is for the board of group health cooperative?
They had a board, but this was...
A subcommittee?
Yeah, the kind of a subcommittee that would feed into the board.
I know. See.
And and then one meeting we came to, Art came with me at this one meeting, or maybe it's because the chairperson couldn't be there for that meeting and asked me to chair it, I think. And that just panicked me. Even I had held offices, well, or an office, with the junior Hadassah as its secretary, but not, I mean, I still wasn't up to that point of wanting to do that. So I asked my husband if he would be willing to run the meeting, and he said, yeah. And so we went together, and I did whatever my job was, I don't remember, and he ran the meeting. And it was also an election time, and so Art, of course, was elected to chair that committee. And from that, then he became aware of the board, and then eventually was elected to the board and became very involved in group health. And of course, you know, it was really a struggling organization, because it took I don't know how many years before group health was recognized by the King County and Washington State Medical Association. And really, you know, took off. But now, of course, it's very well known, and it's considered, my understanding is, it's considered one of the best. In fact, I think it was written up in one of our magazines. I don't know whether it's Newsweek or, anyways, one of those magazines where it was rating HMOs, and group health came out very high, highly rated. So it's really great. And so it's thanks to my brother, who told us about it, and we joined. And then I got involved in it to a certain extent. And then when Art got on the board, he was very involved. They really worked hard. And so I used to read the minutes. And so it was very interesting.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And through that process, you were able to get help for the depression.
And through group health, right, yeah.
And it sounds like in your work that it caused you to make a decision to go back to school.
Right.
Yes,
I think the therapist, the psychiatrist, helped me work through issues that were keeping me, and there was, because there was a lot of fear and a lot of feelings of, you know, what if I can't make it, and things like that. Well, got the strength to go ahead and do it. And that, at that time, it was very unusual. I met one other woman about my age who also had decided to go back later. I guess two women, but one I became good friends with. And then one of my friends, when she saw that, you know, what I was doing, she'd already had 2 years, I think, at the university before she moved here. And she said, well, she might as well finish her degree. And so she came back. I think we graduated at the same time. She came back much later because it was 7 years for me. And I did not go to the graduation because it was just, you know, I mean, I knew everything was huge, and, you know, I wasn't going to sit through an afternoon of that. If I had a free afternoon, I wanted to enjoy it, you know, to do something else. And then I got a couple of calls from people who said, oh, congratulations. You graduated magna cum laude. I didn't know what it meant. And then And then my friend who that finished her last 2 years also called me about that. And so I looked it up to find out what it was. And also it was in the newspaper. So so I know what it is now. And I also, while I was at the university, I had been invited to join the sociology honorary. And in fact, they wanted me to take a part-time job, but I had enough to do with, you know, the family, and my husband would still call me every now and then to help out in the office. And this time, my mother's not that, well, she did have health problems, and so she would ask me to help her. By that time, my grandparents were also having health problems, and so I was helping there. And I was taking the kids now, by this time, they're taking their Hebrew classes midweek, and, you know, it was just, you know, it was just a very busy time.
How did you manage to do all that? What?
There was no free time. I didn't have free time.
But just logistically.
Logistically.
You know, how did you, you know, make dinner or do laundry?
Yeah, I did all those
study,
things. I know I would study at the kitchen table. By that time, we'd gotten a TV. I didn't want the kids sitting in front of the TV, but I'm sure we limited it. I know I'd limited it. But anyway, I know what happened is because we wouldn't get the TV, they were going to the neighbors and watching TV. So this way I'd know what they're watching and how much. So they'd be watching TV, and I'd be studying in the kitchen and doing dinner, and to show you how... You know, it was difficult. I remember one time going to put the potatoes in the oven to bake. I apparently put them in the refrigerator because after I went back to the books, I thought, there was a light on when I put the potatoes in, and our oven doesn't have a light. I better go check this. And they were in the refrigerator. So, I mean, that's, you know, it takes its toll. But, you know, I love learning. It was worth everything, you know, to, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
Now, what were the roles in your marriage at this time? Did your husband, you know, were you the predominant child care provider?
Yes.
How did it work?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, because with his own business, he was putting in very long hours. And then he became very involved in, that's when he started his volunteerism with things like the group health was the biggest chunk. And I don't remember at what point he became active in B'nai B'rith, Jewish Federation, ADL. I mean, there's so many organizations. And so he was gone. He was, he'd leave the house early in the morning before the kids got up, and didn't get home until late, and had many dinner meetings, and so it was pretty difficult.
So you were really managing the household and the kids,
yeah,
and studies.
studies, and then if you need me in the office, come in. I mean, that was very limited. Oh, yeah, I know it. Before I decided to go to the university, I told my husband, now, if you expect me to work at your office, at your business, then I become partner and have a role in decision-making. And if that's not okay with you, I'm going to the University of Washington to get my degree. And he didn't say he wanted me to do that. He didn't say, you know, go to the university. So I went to the university. So that's how it happened. So no, he has become enlightened since then. But back then, he was not an enlightened person. So
so it took a lot of courage for you to make the decision on your own to do that.
Yeah.
And was once you enrolled, was he supportive of
no.
your okay.
No.
So throughout the 7 years
yeah.
you really had to
I was
do
on
it.
My own, yeah.
On your own.
Yeah.
Wow.
And of course oh and my husband was also very active in Rotary, and so you know, every now and then there was a social thing. And I remember, I think it was before I got my degree at the University of Washington. I don't know, came in, you know, what are you doing? And I said, and this fellow Rotarian of my husband said, oh, it's so wonderful of your husband to encourage you to go to the university to support you in this. And of course, I shouldn't say anything. But that, you know, that's the way it was, and but you know, again, it worked, and I was really so happy, and as I say, I loved it, and actually towards the end, I mean the courses I really enjoyed the most were history, and I just loved, so I took as much history as I could.
What type of history?
Well, at that time, I know there was ancient history. World history, Far East history, mm-hmm. so and U.S. history. At one point, I took a course. It was it was the values and that came out of our system of government, which was a fascinating course, and I did like. The sociology classes very much. I found some of the instructors or professors very boring, but I liked the subject matter. And but okay, and I took some psychology courses, and I had a, I couldn't say a dummy for an introductory course. It was a professor there. I remember this large introductory course. He said, well, anybody over 30, you know, they can't learn. They don't learn anymore. I mean, that's how behind things were at those days. And I can't remember what other stupid things he said. So...
What years?
What year was that?
Yeah,
okay, so... let's see.
What, you started back in what year?
Okay, I have to stop. I think it was 50... Okay, Marilyn was 6 years old, so we can do it that way. Eight, 6 and 8 is 54, so it would have been 54.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. And, yeah, it was so unbelievable. anyway.
Describe that a bit. When you say it was so unbelievable. Just
well, that's, you know.
The age, you mean that?
Yeah, that he, and he was, I'm not sure what how old he was, but I would have assumed in the his late 50s or early 60s. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you know, he was stupid. He was not the greatest. But anyway, I got some introductory stuff. And it was not bad. Anyway, but I did take some other courses. But later, I realized that when I went, started, you know, I didn't know whether I'd be able to finish the university. I didn't know whether I had what it took to, you know, be a university student. And then when I realized, you know, I'm going through and I'm doing very well, I will finish while the kids are in junior high school. And And at that time, they needed teachers. There's a real demand for teachers. And so I thought, well, I didn't feel that enthralled by many of my teachers. You know, there were a few that were outstanding. And so I thought, well, I might as well get a teaching degree. I'll keep the major in sociology, get my teaching degree, and then I, you know, have the same schedule as the kids. And so I did that, and I must tell you, I hated almost every education class I took. I couldn't believe them. Mm. I even went to one of the, I think it was a professor, to complain about what he was expecting us to do. I did it two times. That's right, the second time, I had to talk to his assistant. A student assistant, and that didn't do any good. But the first time was a reading course, how to teach reading, and he had us divided into groups, and then we were to work on a project together, and excuse me. And then we were to evaluate each other, had to rank each other, who was the best, did the most, and so on down. And I refused to do it. I was outraged by this. And you know, as you work together with a group of people, everyone's doing something. And so I went to see him. And he was strange. Turns his back to me and faces his bookcase, and we talk. And I think he was so shocked. This is the first time anyone had ever challenged him on that. And so I said, I don't think this is right. And it's like expecting a group, if I were teaching, he was saying, you know, you have to learn to do this. This is a teacher's rank. I said, I would not rank my fellow teachers. I mean, that it's just not right. and it's troubling us, and I just don't think this is the thing to do. And I've heard complaints from many other of the students who are in your class who feel it's wrong also. And I don't know the other exact words, but that was the essence. And I found out later he didn't require it. Now, we didn't rank. I'm sure we didn't rank anyone in our group. And I got a good grade, so you know.
So you were the spokesman.
Yeah, I took it upon myself.
Isn't that something? And did you get the support of your group?
Oh yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So.
How did you take that step? How did you decide to do that?
Oh, I was again enraged. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, it was, you know, and I could hear people, you know, really bothered by it. Nobody wanted to do it. And I certainly didn't want to. I always feel, you know, when I get enraged, I've got to do something. And so that was it. I'm not going to keep that enrage in me when this guy is, you know, causing it.
So it motivates you.
Yeah, to take action. Yeah, and I don't care what's going to happen. I mean, if it means I'm going to get a poor grade, whatever, I don't care. Uh-huh. So that's always my attitude. I found out. I mean, I discovered that's the way I am. So I've done that in my work also.
Yes, and it served you well in so many areas, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's never been a problem.
So you decided, to continue with work in the field of social action. Can you describe it now? Is it right out of college that you went? You worked at the Washington State Employment Service.
No, that came later. A little bit later. Not that much later.
Okay.
Actually, I had a contract with Seattle Public Schools as soon as I even graduated.
Okay.
So I had that, I had an assignment in. In Magnolia at a middle school. Well, no, it was junior high those days. And then somebody had asked at the personnel office that they wanted somebody else to go there. I don't know, there was some connection. And so would I mind going someplace else? And they offered me another junior high school that was actually more convenient. It was one where my kids were going to be, but you know, I didn't see where it'd be a problem because they wouldn't be. It was big enough so they wouldn't have to be in any class I would be teaching. But I didn't know what I was going to be teaching, and I kept calling the school and calling the school and calling the school to try to find out what my assignment would be so I could prepare for it. Well, one day I ran into the principal at a gasoline station in our neighborhood. I was there getting gasoline also. And I told him, I said, I've been trying to get hold of you because I want to find out what I'm going to be teaching so I can prepare. Oh, he says, well, I can tell you. He said, you'll be doing, I believe it was a social studies, maybe in English, and teach beginning Spanish. I said, beginning Spanish? He says, yes, we need somebody to teach beginning Spanish. I said, I had 1 year of high school Spanish, and I had stayed with French for 2 years, and I took 1 year of high school Spanish, which I enjoyed, but that was my senior year. And then when I went to the university that one quarter, I did take a Spanish course, and I really loved the language. But now it's many years later, and obviously I haven't used Spanish, and there never was that much. And I said, no, that's not right. I don't have a Spanish background. I said, it's a beginning class. You just keep ahead of the kids, and you can do it. I said, no, that's wrong. I said, I wouldn't want my children learning Spanish from somebody who's just one lesson ahead. My pronunciation will not be correct because I always had problems with the, you know, getting that sound right. And this, that is just not, well, they said, then you'll have to call the school district and find out where else they can send you. Anyway, so then I got sent to a junior high in Ballard. And of course, I didn't know, you know, what it's like in junior high. And I had social studies and English. But the thing is, I had students from a wide range of ability, from a 15-year-old who was a non-reader in one of my classes to a very bright student, a young girl who was exceedingly bright. And then there was the behavior, the kid who had this uncontrolled behavior problem, and another kid who was always sneaking. And I thought, God, how are you supposed to do this? I mean, it was just awful. And but I thought, well, this is first year, and, you know, get it together. And so then at the end of that school year, they informed me when the Seattle Public Schools enrollment started to drop. So they were shifting teachers then. So they said, well, next year you'll be assigned to a different junior high or whatever. And so I said, okay. Maybe I'll find out earlier this time where I'm going to be teaching and prepare during the summer. So I didn't hear from the school. I had the contract. And I started, I guess in July, started calling the personnel office. And they said, don't call us anymore. We'll call you, and you'll have an assignment. I read in the newspaper the teachers were to report to school the next day. I still hadn't heard. So I called. I said, I have a contract. I don't think the school district is going to want to pay me if I'm not assigned to a school. So then they said, well, you have your choice of, I think it was Hamilton Junior High School, or something on Beacon Hill. Well, Hamilton was closer, and I thought, you know, again, I don't know the difference. So I went to Hamilton. Actually, I had a good experience there. They had me teaching math for students who were not very good at math. And it was eighth grade. And, you know, because I am enthusiastic about math, it went very well. And they did well. In fact, I was told that their standardized math tests were much higher than they had ever scored before. And they were very pleased. And the other classes were fine. And so then in, God, I can't believe what happened in the Seattle School District. Then in December, I had teachers saying, oh, we're going to miss you. It's been so nice having you here. And I think, did I hear right?
Gosh.
So then after hearing it, you know, a couple more times, I decided I better go ask. And so I did. And I found, oh, you were, didn't they tell you? This is just taking the place of one of our teachers who had a sabbatical or something, and he's coming back for the second semester. And so then I was told, well, you can go to Jane Addams, I think was. Anyway, by that time, I was really disgusted. I thought, no. I was going to have to work on a fifth year. I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll start working on my fifth year. And then I also did some volunteer work. And at that time, it was open housing was being voted on. Was to be voted on, and so I worked in that office where actually it was just one of the person who was in charge and myself as a volunteer, but it was very interesting and did a lot of good things, and worked on getting my fifth year. I guess I tried substitute teaching, and that was, yeah, you know, you never knew when you're going to be called, and I didn't want that. But I did start taking classes. And then I guess it was that summer, actually it was my husband who read in the Seattle Times that the federal government was starting a program to work with actually 16 through 21-year-olds who had dropped out of school or had been in trouble with the law, or when minorities who had been kept out of opportunities, and it's going to be called the Youth Opportunity Centers, but you had to apply, and if you're interested, they'll send the application, so it sounded very interesting, like something I would be interested in. It certainly fit in with working with people who, to help bring them up, So I got the application, and I got the references, and I wrote the essay that I had to write, and I can't remember what all. It was quite a process, and I was accepted. And later I found out that it was a country program. I mean, the whole country. This program was
a national.
It was a national program, and that out of the it was something like 22,000 people who applied, 2,000 were selected in the nation, and so and it was a very good program. It was really excellent, and so then after it was, and I can't remember, it was a summer program, very intense. You had to live on campus, and so I did mine at the University of Washington, and so then when we finished, several of us were asked were accepted to work for the Washington State Employment Service in the Youth Opportunity Center that would be starting. And so I was one of the people. And at that time, our son was just graduating, had just also graduated from high school. And he, in the fall, was going to go back to Westland University, called a college, and my husband and I were planning to go back with him. So I told the I can't remember his title. Anyway, he was head of the office in Seattle for Washington State Employment Service. He was really a wonderful person, and explained the situation. He says, "Well, we definitely want you," and So when you come back from your trip, just, you know, call and we'll get you in. So that's how I got started at Washington State Employment Service. And the Youth Opportunity Centers didn't last that long.
What years?
Were they? Okay, that would have been, I think, 63. Oh, wait, I just, let's see. So our son graduated. I have to stop and think when he graduated. He graduated, I'm pretty sure, 1966. Oh, well, then it would have been probably 1966. No, I'm wrong about that. I think he graduated. No, about there, 65, 66. I don't know if I have the dates there. Somewhere's around there.
He was born in 46.
Right.
So
yeah.
Isn't that 64, maybe 65?
I think so. There, probably 64. I think it would. Yeah, 64 sounds right.
What was it like at the time? So, you know, the climate in the country and.
Well, this is when, I guess it was President Johnson. Yeah, was our president. And well, to me, I felt a lot of excitement that the federal government was getting involved in trying to help those who've been oppressed and didn't have the opportunities to get on with their lives. And so I was really quite excited about that. So I felt very good about it. And those of us, you know, involved, you know, were pretty idealistic and, you know, had the same thing. So it was a good group to be with. And it was quite good.
Now, your husband had shown you the article. So.
Yeah, he did show. So that's support.
So he,
yes.
His, I forget the word that you used before, enlightenment started.
Yes, that's right, that's right,
is this
yeah.
When it started to...
I guess so, I think so, yeah, there was a change. And so that's when I got started there, and I worked there for 9 years. Youth Opportunity Center only lasted a few years. And then we were, those who were to remain in counseling positions were to get a master's in counseling. So, and the federal government paid for it, paid for everything and my salary.
Is that right? So you.
It was just amazing.
Back to the University of Washington?
Yeah.
To get your master's?
Right, yeah. And oh, at this time, our daughter had already graduated from high school. Yeah, that would have been, that was 66, I think. And so she was going off to the University of Denver, and so I thought, well, I really have the time to really work. And so I carried heavy loads, which I didn't realize you don't do as a graduate student, but I did it, and I got through in 1 year. They did take some of the work that I did in that summer program. They did take some credits for that, and I can't remember. But anyway, so I was able to do it in 1 year.
So you completed a master's degree in 1 year while you were working?
No, I didn't have to work.
So they allowed you time to...
I didn't have to work that year, and they not only paid tuition books, but they also paid me my salary. I mean...
To go to school.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable. So I got that, and then when I came back, then... there was no Youth Opportunity Center, and I was made a supervisor of a counseling group. And at this time, it was I worked both in Seattle and in Everett. So I can't remember, 2 days a week in Everett, and 3 in Seattle, something like that. And I really loved it, and because I had some great people that I supervised, worked with, I should say. So it was just really a wonderful experience. And then that program changed. And they made me supervisor of the group that was in charge of the training programs that one that the Employment Security was to handle for the federal government. I think it was the Manpower Training Act, something like that. And so that was a very different experience, because one of the men that I had to supervise had been with the agency for years and years and years, and nobody told him anything. But it was really, he was doing a good job, so it was just mainly to be aware of what he was doing and let him know when there was anything that had to be changed. And also supervise some other people, and so it was a good experience.
What were the rewards and challenges of working in these different positions?
Yeah, well, one, I guess, because I was working in programs that were to benefit people who had been kept out of the mainstream, so I felt good about that, very good about that. I felt good because there were still a lot of the people, even though the Youth Opportunity Center went by the, you know, was stopped. They changed programs is what they did. So then they were working with, I think still, the emphasis was more on adults and young adults, but again, people from disadvantaged programs who had criminal records or minority background, poverty, and or high school dropouts, whatever. And so it was a chance to, it was a chance to learn about, you know, what we can do and what's out there and what it is like working with, you know, these people. And so I just felt good about the experience. It was good experience. And then oh yes, because I did get my master's degree through the state agency, I had to put in 2 years. So I'm really glad I did it in 1 year, because then I had to put in 2 years of work before I could consider leaving. Because what I really wanted to do at this, by this time, I wanted to be a counselor in a community college. I thought that would be great, because they're getting, you know, would be getting, working with a lot of the same kind of populations. And and in fact, I did my internship at Seattle Central Community College. But my husband at this point was on, also on the board of Seattle Community College District. And so they said, sorry, we'd love to have you, but your husband's on the board and we can't do it. So I didn't get that one. And and I did look at some other community colleges, but didn't, nothing came. I didn't pursue it that much, but anyway.
So at that time, if a spouse was on serving on the board, they wouldn't allow the...
Well, that's what they told me.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Mm. And I know I got it from different sources, so I'm sure that was true.
Yeah.
And so... Oh, so then they made me, a couple of times, I really had some strange experiences. Well, I thought they were strange experiences. I still had my master's. I was to be manager of what they called the casual labor office, and that's where, it was, at that time we called it Skid Row, not, you know, Pioneer Square area. It was, they were just beginning to start this movement towards upgrading and making it fancier, but it was still really very run down. And that's where the office was located. It was located at the corner of Western and Yesler Way. And they needed a manager of that office, because they felt the office had been not a part of the whole system. They were really to themselves too much, and they needed to know what we're doing, and they wanted to upgrade that office, and they wanted me to find a building, and so forth. And well, when I heard that they were, that's what they wanted me to do, I just couldn't believe it. But I didn't know whether to cry or laugh.
Why is that?
Well, the two men that ran the office had reputations of being very tough and very independent, and it was an all-men's. They really served men there, no women.
So they
were mainly people who were looking for day labor. So the longshore union would call the office when they needed extra longshoremen. They did no longer had their union people, and they needed them, so they'd call our office. Farm labor, day labor, and any other kind of day labor. So the waiting area was filled with men, you know, looking for these different jobs, and some were, I could tell, were on drugs. And
were you the only woman in
When I came there, I was the only woman. And what I said, you know, after I saw what the situation was like, I think it's before I went there, but they already told me that's what's going to be my next assignment. I said, well, I really don't want to be manager of that office, but I'm willing to be the acting manager, and I'll carry out the things that you want me to do, but I don't want to stay there, and as soon as I do what you want me to do, then I would like to be transferred someplace else. So, okay. So I spent a lot of time looking for a building because they wanted me to do that. Nothing ever came of it, but anyway, but I did that. And then I had to go in gently and let them know, you know, what the main office wanted, and ask them to let me know, you know, what they mainly do there and how they do it, and so I can become familiar. And I said, and I'm here as an acting manager, because as soon as their goals are met, then I'm leaving. Well, that, you know, worked out fine.
How were you received by
coworkers? Oh, the workers?
Colleagues, your co-workers.
Oh, the co-workers. Well, in the office, these two men. One was very nice. He was gentle, and he was really just a real gentleman. And he sort of looked out for me. The other was kind of rough. But then they were both really, the other one came around too. They were very, very nice. And, you know, and so they, you know, explained what they do and how they do it. One of the other goals was they wanted to also serve women that were looking for day jobs. And although I didn't know really how that was going to be done, but I knew that women were not to be turned down from any job that they could do. And I was very, I had really become involved in trying to get men accepted for office jobs, and would get stories like, oh, the other people in the office would never accept that. So it was a hard one to crack. Oh, no, we wouldn't want a woman doing that because, you know, it's very heavy work. And even though I'd say, you know, they can do it, that's what they want to do. So it was difficult, but I was going to keep trying. And so I remember the first time I got a call at that casual labor office for they needed longshore men, I said, well, I'll see what we can find, and if we have any women that want to do this and have the strength to do it, I'll send them too. This guy had a fit at the other end, and he came down to the office very quickly, within a matter of minutes, to talk to me and see if he could believe it. And so that was an interesting experience. However, I don't even know if any women had any women come in to ask for that kind of work.
How did you respond to him when he came in?
I talked to him. I said, well, you know, if there's somebody that is able to do the work, you can't discriminate. You know, that's the law now. Well, I think he sort of shook his head and left.
What qualities? I mean, I think that what I'm hearing is that time and time again, you've really confronted issues.
Right. Yeah.
In very productive ways.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what qualities you use within yourself when you handle those situations.
Well, I guess, again, it's always that feeling of this is an injustice. And I grew up really being angry because I could see the difference. My older brother would get jobs that paid more than I got, although I did get one job. When I got my job at the Valmarché as a senior in high school, I was getting paid more than he was at Frederick Nelson. I felt very good about that. But you know, and I can even remember this older brother saying to me, you know, oh, you should do that because that's really nice for girls to do. And being just outraged and, excuse me while I take some water.
So it sounds like you observed women being treated differently from men in work positions as well. What about with education, or was it mostly in the workforce?
I guess with education, I knew that women could go to the university and could get a good education if they wanted to, so I felt it was up to the woman that they were not being kept out. But I know that in many cases the parents didn't encourage it. And as I said, with me, somehow I absorbed that my parents expected me to go to college. But I don't know how or why, and I'm not sure. But that's the feeling I had, and that's enough, you know. So it was really in jobs, and the fact that women could become nurses, teachers. They were pretty limited jobs that women could do, and yet men could do all these other kinds of things and get paid more. And I remember my brother, older brother, sorry about the,
okay.
We do have a train that goes by.
No problem.
And he got jobs on ships. Some were cruise ships, some were freighters, and so he had many trips to Alaska. Well, he'd do this during the summer when he was going to the university, and then he also had a trip to China, and I think that's just not fair. Why can't I do that too? There's no reason why I can't do that. And so there was always this, you know, resentment of people trying to say what women should do, what's nice for women, that women are not supposed to do this, that, or the other thing. So I did resent it very much.
Did you have a support network with other women?
No, I really didn't.
Okay.
As far as I know, I always felt like I was different from everybody.
Is that right? How, what do you mean?
But I suppose mainly because I didn't talk to, you know, because I kept things to myself. I guess because of the fact that I felt things so strongly about the injustices that I saw around me and didn't hear other people complain about, that I overheard, even when I was at the university that short time, some students, young women students behind me, were saying, oh, you know, we only go to the university to get our husbands. They were talking to themselves, and I thought, oh, you know, that's so stupid. That's what was pushed. You know, you get married and then you stay home. So I just didn't accept these things. And I guess because there was this strong sense of just because things are done, that doesn't mean you have to continue doing it. And it doesn't mean you don't try to change things. So I just have always felt a little different.
It's so fascinating to hear you talk about this. And I'm wondering if there were any other values that you were exposed to growing up, Jewish values or other values that supplemented this belief or these beliefs in you.
Well, there must have been something Oh, I guess, you know, another example. I resented the fact that teachers could not be married when I was in school. But then they would say, well, you know, it's the Depression, and so we have to give the jobs to the men. Well, you know, they're women heads of households, and so, the, you know, that I felt was so wrong. So I don't know, I just saw things, and, you know, why, well, I guess I could see differences the way my older brother, things he could do, and what, and where I couldn't do because I was a girl. And so I guess it's just feeling that sense of, you know, injustice. This is not right, you know. And I remember thinking, well, I know that, this was later when I went back to the university as an older student, sitting next to a couple of young Jewish students, males, and thinking, it was a large sociology class, and I always got the best grades. I don't believe they posted them or something. And I said something about, I don't know, anyway, but what I thought was, you know, these guys are going to get good jobs. In fact, one of them did become an attorney. I don't remember the other one, what happened, what he did. And they're going to make a lot of money. You know, I'll be lucky to just get a job, and it'll just pay an ordinary, you know, it won't be a lot of money. And that was another area, you know, the differences that women, at that time, women weren't lawyers. There might have been some, but I didn't know of any. And they really weren't doctors, although, again, there probably were a couple. But in the professions, they were not really there, and you were discouraged. And I also had thought of medicine. That's another field I'm very much interested in. But I thought, they said you couldn't apply if you were over a certain age, and for a woman it'd be very hard. I am sure it was not the field for me, because you really do need a lot of energy for that. And we have a grandson who just became a doctor. So I'm sure I couldn't have done
it. Although it's very hard to imagine you without energy.
All
that you've done raising a family, it's very hard to imagine you low energy.
But I've always needed my sleep.
You must have been a good sleeper. Is that?
I don't know. I do remember I was always tired.
So by the end of the day.
Oh yeah, I was tired. So yeah, but anyway, yeah. So I guess, you know, I really don't know where these values, because they were not generally held by the public. I guess that's why I felt like an oddball. I could see these. Sorry about that. I'll get it. It's a good thing he's here.
Were there any Jewish values that you remember hearing growing up in your home?
Well, I know the importance of tzedakah. I'm not saying it right.
Tzedakah. Okay.
Thank you. That was something I really was very strong. Mm-hmm. And even I know that when we, and having married young, and even though we had very little money, and I mean, that time I used to get soup bones. They didn't charge for them in the soup market, and then the supermarket. And I would make these wonderful soups that I sort of remember that my mother made and my grandmother. And very nutritious, I found out later. But they were good. And, you know, meat was a rarity because I just didn't have the money. So, sorry, I got sidetracked.
So you were talking about tzedakah.
So even though we didn't have much money, we always managed to give something. So, you know, that was the strongest value, that you always helped out your fellow Jew. And Zionism became very important. Of course, that's, you know, came later, but because of what was happening in Europe and that the Jews didn't have a home. And so I felt very, very strongly about that as a young person. In fact, I would have loved to have gone to Palestine. But, so, I guess it's more, somehow, the sense of social justice, which is really part of the religion, is, it just became a part of me.
Mm-hmm. It's really part of who you are.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? You know, our tape is almost over
okay.
for the second tape. So why don't we stop here
okay.
so I don't have to interrupt you later.
Okay, all right.